Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 548, titled Tibet or Not Tibet. This is being recorded on April 16th of the year 2006. Well, happy Easter to all of you out there who are Christians. I'm recording this on Easter Sunday, and this past week was also Passover. I mention that because we are once again going to be taking a look at a potentially touchy subject, that of religion and fascism, so I'll give my usual caveat. I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing all of Buddhism in any way as fascist or even necessarily all of Tibetan Buddhism. However, there is present within Tibetan Buddhism, as with many other religions around the world, a fascist element and or one that has been adapted very successfully to one of fascism's worst elements, namely the occult-driven elements of the SS. Last week, we took a look at how certain aspects of the philosophy of Tibetan Buddhism can be adapted to a fascist and or warlike viewpoint. This week, we're going to be taking a look not only at some of the sexual occultism that is present within aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, but we're also going to take a look in particular at, first of all, the Tibetan society as it was before the Chinese communists invaded, and this should not be misunderstood as holding a brief for them or what they did, but rather in terms of evaluating not only the Dalai Lama, but the, here we go, milieu of which he is a part. It is, I think, important to take a look at that. And it's also very important to study who the Dalai Lama associates with and what causes he espouses. Now, in that regard, a couple of corrections, actually several corrections. First of all, I erred in speaking of the SS officers Heinrich Harrer and Bruno Begier, both of them, by the way, associates of the Dalai Lama over a long period of time, as members of the Tibetan government in exile. The gathering of which they were a part was under the auspices of the Tibetan government in exile, and they are supportive of that, but they are not actually officials with the Tibetan government in exile. So I want to make that clear. The site that talked about this particular gig was, in fact, under the auspices of the Tibetan government in exile. The gathering in question was in London in 1994. The Dalai Lama assembled seven people, including these two former SS officers, one of them his tutor and the other a first-class war criminal. And they were to reminisce about Tibetan society and what a cohesive, it's sort of like, you know, good old Tibet kind of thing. The gathering under the auspices of the Tibetan government exile was to gain firsthand and, I guess, wistful recollections of what Tibet was like prior to the Chinese invasion. The Dalai Lama's association with these people is more than a little significant. However, again, the two SS officers are not actually officials with the Tibetan government in exile. Part of the source of confusion, and I'll alert people to this, in discussion of the Tibetan government in exile and people who support it or have given testimonials on its favor or appeared at events sponsored by it, there is a sort of journalistic shorthand employed by that group and its supporters that sometimes refers to people as part of the government of Tibet in exile as a kind of a larger sort of philosophical, spiritual slash, you know, groovy kind of concept. That was one source of the confusion. So if you see that in the future, be aware of that. Sometimes people who are simply of the persuasion, so to speak, are referred to as part of the larger, quote, Tibetan government in exile, unquote. If they were Dave Emery, they'd know what to say. They'd call it a milieu, but they just don't have that down. Anyway, be aware of that. Two other corrections. The German expert on Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism in particular, who is described by the Trimaldis as a Nazi, is named Durkheim, not Dorkheim. There was an error with character recognition software. Likewise, the other SS war criminal with whom the Dalai Lama has a long association, according to the Trimaldis, is named La Riviere, not La Revivre. Okay? So be aware of that. Now, we're going to once again in this broadcast return to the subject of the Dalai Lama as a political animal. A couple of things that I'm going to note in the description of the program. I'm not going to go into them at length here, but I will mention them in passing. This past week, there were a couple of articles just in the last couple of days of the Dalai Lama visiting the United States, meeting with Muslim organizations in order to promote understanding, and also meeting with American counterterror people in order to help foster understanding of Islam. This, by the way, of furthering world peace. A noble-sounding endeavor, certainly, very worthwhile goal, certainly. However, as we're going to see with the Dalai Lama, whatever goes on between his ears, and I'd be the last one to try to venture a thought in that regard, the Dalai Lama actually, though, has a long history, not only of involvement with politics, but significant involvement over a period of decades with the world of covert action. And it would appear that that world of black ops, so to speak, involves not only elements of U.S. intelligence, and perhaps still does, but also elements of the underground Reich. And we're going to take a look at that in just a minute. By the way, we're also going to take a look at considerable length at the idealized Tibetan society. But I want to note that this past week, the Dalai Lama was in the Bay Area and elsewhere in the U.S. to promote understanding of Islam. As we're going to see, we're going to Dalai out, so to speak. The camera's going to Dalai out, and in the larger focus to which we will be returning late in the program, we're going to see how the Dalai Lama is involved with a non-governmental organization loosely associated with the United Nations. It's not a UN group, but it at least touts its recognition by the UN. It's an organization called the Underrepresented People's Organization, and it appears to be sort of the classic 90s/2000 covert action front, a peaceful, highly evolved-sounding non-governmental organizations have been an Orwellian selection for vehicles for covert action over the last couple of decades. And the UNPO, as it's called, would appear to be one of those. As we're going to see in taking a look at the Dalai Lama, he is associated not only with Uyghur separatists, very active in promoting the secession of Xinjiang province in China, which has a large Muslim population and which also, not incidentally, has a lot of China's natural resources, a lot of China's mineral and, surprise, surprise, petroleum resources, which are considerable, are in the largely Muslim Uyghur dominated Xinjiang province. And in addition, the Dalai Lama's web of associations also overlaps explicit Islamist elements as well. One of the things that I want to mention in connection with the Dalai Lama, also, once again, by way of caveat, people who are sympathetic to the Dalai Lama or Tibetan Buddhism shouldn't take this seriously. They shouldn't take it not seriously. They should take it very seriously, but they shouldn't take it personally, is what I meant to say. We're going to get into the substantive material of the broadcast by repeating a short section of an essay that appeared in Salon magazine in 1998, this by Christopher Hitchens, who made a very sage observation. He observed that, quote, "The greatest triumph that modern public relations can offer is the transcendent success of having your words and actions judged by your reputation rather than the other way around." The spiritual leader, unquote, of Tibet has enjoyed this unassailable status for some time now, becoming a byword and synonym for saintly and ethereal values. Why this doesn't put people on their guard, I'll never know. Well, not only is Christopher Hitchens hit on something that's very valid here, but it dovetails with a couple of points of reference that I'll use to sort of ease us into a discussion of the reality of the Dalai Lama as opposed to the general conception. Hitler in Mein Kampf had a very interesting observation about the concept of the big lie. I think the fact that we hear about the idea of the big lie so often, and it's a fairly common element in political discourse, I think it blinds us to what an important and effective concept it is. In Mein Kampf, his autobiography and political manifesto, Hitler discussed the big lie in a passage that goes, "Most people tell little lies. They would be ashamed to tell big ones. They would never credit others with such great impudence as the complete reversal of fact. Even explanations would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, as any trifling detail would dispose them to accept a thing as true. All good liars know this, therefore, and stop at nothing to achieve this end." It is a very interesting passage, and I think it applies to the Dalai Lama. There's also an experiment in social psychology. A person who is the focal point of the experiment is placed in a room with a bunch of people, usually other students or graduate students, who are sort of in on the joke. The teacher, the instructor, the experimenter, draws two lines, two chalk lines on the blackboard, one of which is very much longer than the other. All of the people in the room are coached to say that the longer line is, in fact, the shorter, and the other way around. The teacher goes around and asks everybody in the room which of the two lines is shorter. Until they get to the person who's the focal point of the experiment, that's the very last person, and the vast majority of people fall in line. They say that the longer line is the shorter line because they don't want to appear to be out of step. Some people afterward, when cued in on the experiment, have actually said that they began to see the longer line as the shorter line. So in terms of understanding, in terms of cognition, remember, as Christopher Hitchens said, the greatest triumph that modern public relations can offer is the transcendent success of having your words and actions judged by your reputation rather than the other way around. And among the things to sort of give people a substantive introduction to what we're going to be talking about, the Dalai Lama has certainly been the beneficiary of some very, very good public relations and some rather skilled intelligence. The Dalai Lama, by the way, when asked about his SS associates, said he didn't know about their backgrounds, but he continued to associate with them and to work with them long after he became aware of them. As we shall see, that the Dalai Lama is not lacking for skilled intelligence informants in his milieu. We're going to be taking a look at an essay in just a few minutes by author and social critic Michael Parenti. In that essay, he notes something that's quite well known by now, the fact that the Dalai Lama has had a long-standing relationship with the elements of the CIA. Parenti writes, "However, throughout the 1960s, the Tibetan exile community was secretly pocketing $1.7 million a year from the CIA, according to documents released by the State Department in 1998. Once this fact was publicized, the Dalai Lama's organization itself issued a statement admitting that it had received millions of dollars from the CIA during the 1960s to send armed squads of exiles into Tibet to undermine the Maoist revolution. The Dalai Lama's annual payment from the CIA was $186,000. Indian intelligence also financed both him and other Tibetan exiles. He has refused to say whether he or his brothers worked for the CIA. The agency has also declined to comment." So again, when the Dalai Lama says he didn't know who these SS guys were, well, he continues to associate with them, and he is not lacking for skilled observers, shall we say. Now, before we get into the Tibet of old, so to speak, good old Tibet, we're going to be taking a look at an essay by the, or another section of an essay by the Tremondis. It's actually the transcript of an interview. The Tremondis is a pseudonym for a couple of authors and publishers who formerly were not only among the Dalai Lama's closest professional associates in Germany, not only publishing his material, but they were religious devotees of him and followers of him. They came to be some of his strongest critics. Last week, we took a look at how some features of Tibetan Buddhism can adapt well to an apocalyptic sort of fascistic and totalitarian viewpoint. That, no doubt, is what attracted Heinrich Himmler and elements of the SS to Tibetan Buddhism as perhaps the ancestors of the, quote, Aryan warrior spirit, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to take a look in this broadcast at another feature that Tibetan Buddhism manifests, which has also been a focal point of much criticism, namely, and this, I first heard about this, and I checked this out with someone I know who is an expert on such matters. I am not unknowledgeable myself about Buddhism, but I don't know much about Tibetan Buddhism, and I checked with someone who does, and he corroborated what I'm talking about. He described it to me. He said, Tibetan Buddhism has as much to do with the sort of Buddhism with which you're familiar as Aleister Crowley does. It's sort of an Aleister Crowley adaptation of Buddhism was one way he put it to me. This is from an interview with the Tremondis, Victor and Victoria Tremondi, by James Stevens. And in this interview, he asks the Tremondis about some of the Tibetan Buddhist sexual rituals, aspects of Tibetan Buddhist sexual ritual, and also about numerous accounts of sexual abuse within the Tibetan religious hierarchy, not unlike those that have recently come to light in conjunction with the Catholic priesthood. In this interview, the Tremondis reply to the question by James Stevens, "The sexual practices of Buddhist tantrism are not to be confused with normal sexual abuse by some lamas. The latter also has been a great problem in the Buddhist communities, which were rocked by scandals caused by such prominent leaders as Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, founder of Colorado's Naropa University, who was accused of having sex with his women students. In 1993, 21 Western Buddhist teachers met the Dalai Lama in India and issued an open letter that lamented various teachers' quote, sexual misconduct with their students, abuse of alcohol and drugs, misappropriation of funds, and misuse of power," unquote. The group urged believers to confront teachers and publicize their misconduct. Here in Europe, one of the most well-known and discussed cases involved the Scottish Buddhist June Campbell and the attempt of her teacher, the most honorable 80-year-old Lama Kalu Rinpoche, to misuse her sexually. The February 10, 1999 headline of the British newspaper The Independent read, quote, "I was a tantric sex slave," unquote. But Campbell shows also in her confessional book, Traveler in Space, that the sexual misuse of women is not only a blamable attitude, but that it is a central part of the Lamaist tantric religion. The sexual magic practice exercised by a Lama with a woman has the specific goal to transmit the erotic and female energy into the spiritual and worldly power of the male partner. Such sexual rituals are the core of Tibetan Buddhism. Also, in the secret higher initiations of the Kalachakra Tantra, sexual magical rites take place. The ritual texts can be interpreted symbolically or literally. Both are possible. The originals say that 11-year-old girls may be used as sexual partners. By the way, I want to note, skipping down, I'm going to repeat a short section of text from the interview with the Tremondis that we read last week. In our historical essay, Hitler, Buddha, Krishna, An Unholy Alliance from the Third Reich to Today, we show that the warlike and racist tendencies of Heinrich Himmler of the SS and of other well-known neo-fascists have been fundamentally inspired by elements of different Asian religions, such as Vedism, Buddhism, Lamaism, and that prominent German Zen teachers Durkheim and Herigel have been convinced Nazis. That book, by the way, is a bestseller in Germany. And again, the Tremondis were very, very close professional and religious associates of the Dalai Lama before they found out what was actually going on and basically changed their tune. By the way, something else that I'm going to be putting in the description to the program that I'm not going to include in the broadcast per se due to limitations of time. The Dalai Lama, in very un-Dalai-like fashion, came out and endorsed the advent of the Pakistani bomb and nuclear testing. He basically said he thought it was a great sort of self-fulfillment of third world destiny, et cetera, et cetera. Very un-Dalai-like thing to do, to endorse the development of nuclear weapons. He also was one of the leading figures pushing for the release of Augusto Pinochet after he was taken into custody when he went abroad. And that, again, a very un-Dalai-like thing to do. But note what the Christopher Hitchens said, basically. The main success of modern public relations is the transcendent success of having your words and actions judged by your reputation rather than the other way around. A deceptively brief and simple observation by Christopher Hitchens. Now, we're going to take a look at an essay by Michael Parenti, the author and social critic, talking about what Tibet was like before the Chinese communists came in. This should not, again, in any way be misunderstood as holding a brief for what the Chinese did or do or for invasion or for Maoism or for anything else, but rather what we're going to be taking a look at is the reality of Tibetan society before the Chinese communists moved in order to get some idea of the credibility and of the ideological foundation for the Dalai Lama, who, his religious beliefs aside, is a political animal, and as we're going to see, is certainly part of, whether willingly or naively, part of a covert action milieu that overlaps not only elements of U.S. intelligence over the years, but the underground Reich. And that is a covert action milieu in which his SS buddies, Bruno Begay and Heinrich Harrer, were more than a little comfortable. And the full URL for this Parenti essay will be on the description for this program. Skipping down in this essay by Parenti about Buddhist exceptionalism, but what of the Dalai Lama and the Tibet he presided over before the Chinese crackdown in 1959? It is widely held by many devout Buddhists that old Tibet was a spiritually oriented kingdom free from the egotistical lifestyles, empty materialism, and corrupting vices that beset modern industrial society. Western news media, travel books, novels, and Hollywood films have portrayed the Tibetan theocracy as a veritable Shangri-La. The Dalai Lama himself stated that, quote, the pervasive influence of Buddhism, unquote, in Tibet, again quoting, amid the wide open spaces of an unspoiled environment, resulted in a society dedicated to peace and harmony. We enjoyed freedom and contentment, unquote. A reading of Tibet's history suggests a different picture. In the 13th century, Emperor Kublai Khan created the first Grand Lama, who was to preside over all the other lamas as might a pope over his bishops. Several centuries later, the Emperor of China sent an army into Tibet to support the Grand Lama, an ambitious 25-year-old man who then gave himself the title of Dalai or Ocean Lama, ruler of all Tibet. Here is quite an historical irony. The first Dalai Lama was installed by a Chinese army, and I would note, basically was in that position by virtue of his dedication to political and military hegemony over all of Tibet. Continuing. Sounds like attachment to me, folks. Very un-Buddhist-like. To elevate his authority beyond worldly challenge, the first Dalai Lama seized monasteries that did not belong to his sect and is believed to have destroyed Buddhist writings that conflicted with his claim to divinity. The Dalai Lama who succeeded him pursued a sybaritic life, enjoying many mistresses, partying with friends, and acting in other ways deemed unfitting for an incarnate deity. For this, he was done in by his priests. Within 107 years, despite their recognized status as gods, five Dalai Lamas were murdered by their high priests or other courtiers. And then Shangri-La for Lords and Lamas is the next section of Parenti's essay. Religion's about a close relationship not only with violence, but with economic exploitation. Indeed, it is often the economic exploitation that necessitates the violence. Such was the case with the Tibetan theocracy. Until 1959, when the Dalai Lama last presided over Tibet, most of the arable land was still organized into manorial estates worked by serfs. Even a writer sympathetic to the old order allows that, quote, a great deal of real estate belonged to the monasteries, and most of them amassed great riches. In addition, individual monks and lamas were able to accumulate great wealth through active participation in trade, commerce, and money lending, unquote. Drepung Monasteries was one of the biggest landowners in the world, with 185 manors, 25,000 serfs, 300 great pastures, and 16,000 herdsmen. The wealth of the monasteries went mostly to the higher-ranking lamas, many of them scions of aristocratic families. Secular leaders also did well. A notable example was the commander-in-chief of the Tibetan army, who owned 4,000 square kilometers of land and had 3,500 serfs. And he also was a member of the Dalai Lama's lay cabinet. Old Tibet has been misrepresented by some of its Western admirers as, quote, a nation that required no police force because its people voluntarily observed the laws of karma, unquote. In fact, it had a professional army, albeit a small one, that served as a gendarmerie for the landlords to keep order and to hunt down runaway serfs. Young Tibetan boys were regularly taken from their families and brought into the monasteries to be trained as monks. Once there, they became bonded for life. Tashi Tsering, a monk, reports that it was common for peasant children to be sexually mistreated in the monasteries. He himself was a victim of repeated rape beginning at age 9. The monastic estates also conscripted impoverished peasant children for lifelong servitude as domestics, dance performers, and soldiers. In Old Tibet, there were small numbers of farmers who subsisted as a kind of free peasantry, and perhaps an additional 10,000 people who composed the, quote, middle class, unquote, families of merchants, shopkeepers, and small traders. Thousands of others were beggars. A small minority were slaves, usually domestic servants who owned nothing. Their offspring were born into slavery. The greater part of the rural population, some 700,000 of an estimated total of 1,250,000, were serfs. Serfs and other peasants generally were little better than slaves. They went without schooling or medical care. They spent most of their time laboring for high-ranking lamas or for the secular landed aristocracy. Their masters told them what crops to grow and what animals to raise. They could not get married without the consent of their lord or lama, and they might easily be separated from their families should their owners send them to work in a distant location. Sounds kind of like Porgy and Bess go to Tibet, huh? Anyway, as I mentioned, we're almost out of time. There will be a long written description of this broadcast up on the Spitfire website, a WWW Spitfire list within a couple of weeks of recording it. The Spitfire website is a vast resource for information that will flesh out your understanding for the admittedly dense and pedantic format of the For the Record broadcasts. So do check out the For the Record section for the descriptions, linked websites for audio files, and printed information that will help to flesh out your understanding of the events that I'm talking about. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 548, Tibet or Not Tibet, being recorded on April 16th of the year 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.